Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you for the invitation and for inviting such a wonderful collection of speakers and of interlocutors. It's been a wonderful education for a glutton for the philosophy of biology like me. But of course, you're all very tired at the end of 3 days of this, so I've cut many pages from my talk. And before I begin, in spite of the fact that I've been preempted by Kevin, I want to thank Stephen Humphrey. And where is he? Would you stand up and take a bow, Stephen? Because my own subdivision of philosophy owes, like many other subdivisions of philosophy, a debt to you for your continued support of the enterprise of philosophy here at Santa Barbara. When a philosopher advances a purely a priori argument to show that a well-established scientific theory is fatally defective, it's usually safe to assume that the problem is the philosopher's and not the theory's. But sometimes the philosopher's onto something, and the outcome results in an improvement in the theory or an important realization about its hitherto unrecognized implications. On these occasions, however, the philosopher is usually in the dark about what his argument has really shown. An example is worth recalling. Famously, in 1935, Einstein, along with Podolsky and Rosen, the EPR, raised an a priori objection to quantum mechanics. Its truth required spooky action at a distance. Accordingly, Einstein always insisted that quantum mechanics was incomplete. There had to be a deterministic hidden variable theory at work. Few physicists accepted the EPR thought experiment as right until it turned out that spooky action at a distance actually obtained, just as Einstein said it had to for quantum indeterminism to be right. In effect, EPR's modus tollens argument was turned into a modus ponens that taught us something new about reality. This is the way we should treat Jerry Fodor's arguments against Darwin's theory. His modus tollens is a biologist's and cognitive scientist's modus ponens. Assuming his argument is valid, the right conclusion is not that Darwinian theory is mistaken, but that Jerry's and any other non-Darwinian approach to the mind is mistaken. That puts Jerry in good company, of course. Einstein's. The way Jerry went wrong is also instructive. It shows how getting things wrong in the philosophy of biology leads, and not even for the first time, to conclusions with the potential to damage the acceptance of a theory, damage with harmful consequences for human well-being. Jerry was fated to attack Darwinian theory long before he actually did so, but it took him some years to realize his fated, if not fatal, repulsion. It started with teleosemantics and his attack on the very idea of it in The Theory of Content, 1990. But it took at least 17 years for the penny to drop and for Jerry to realize that it was Darwin he needed to refute, not Dennett, Bennett, Millikan, Dretzky, Neander, Lloyd, Papineau, Mathen, and their fellow travelers. In the period after Dan Dennett, I'm going to cut that and go. Teleosemantics maintains that the neural circuitry in the frog that produces fly snapping has been tuned up by phylogenetically by natural selection and ontogenetically, developmentally by the law of effect, by operant conditioning, Darwin's chip off the old block. And it claims that the neural circuitry's intentional content consists in those phylogenetic and ontogenetic facts about it. This is where Jerry throws a spanner in the works. He shows that it can't be done. You cannot analyze intentional content by appeal to etiology, phylogenetic or ontogenetic. Etiology of the wet stuff in the brain, the neural circuitry that gives rise to the purpose of behavior, no matter how exquisitely appropriate the behavior is to its circumstances. Here's Fodorian prose at its best. The moral, to repeat, is that Darwin doesn't care how you describe the intentional objects of frog snaps. All that matters for selection is how many flies the frog manages to ingest in consequence of its snapping, and this number comes out exactly the same whether one describes the function of snap guidance mechanism with respect to the world that is populated by flies that are de facto ambient black dots, or with respect to a world that is populated by ambient black dots that are de facto flies. Es kommt das Fressen, dann kommt die Morale. That's from Brecht. Right, Jerry? Darwin cares how many flies you eat, but not what description you eat them under. The technical issue facing teleosemantics is indeterminacy of propositional content. The most exquisite environmental appropriateness of the behavior produced by some neural circuits firing won't narrow down its content to one unique proposition. Jerry labeled this indeterminacy issue the disjunction problem, and ever since, many writers have used it as a stick with which to beat all causal theories of content. In the actual environment in which frogs evolved, and in the actual environment in which this frog learned how to make a living, the neural circuitry that was selected for causing the fly's tongue to snap at the fly at X, Y, Z, T, is supposed to have the content fly at X, Y, Z, T. But phylogenetic and ontogenetic Darwinian processes of selection can't discriminate among indefinitely many other alternative neural contents with the same effect in tongue-snapping behavior. It's now famous that there is no way any teleosemantic theory can tell whether the content of the relevant frog's neural circuit is fly or black dot at XYZT, or fly or BB at XYZT, or any of a zillion other disjunctive objects of thought, so long as none of these disjuncts has ever actually been presented to the fly, whence the name disjunction problem. The slides are so that if you begin to tune out to the monotone of my voice, you can follow the argument on the overhead. Once he began to pursue this line of argument against teleosemantics, it was inevitable that Jerry would eventually have to repudiate Darwin's theory altogether. The specific reason is roughly that any naturalistic, purely causal, non-semantic account of content will have to rely on Darwinian natural selection to build and operate contentful neural states. The more general reason Jerry would have to repudiate Darwin is that no causal theory whatever, including Jerry's favorite one, can account for determinate semantic content, and so eo ipso, a Darwinian theory, can't do it either. How surprising should this be? Roughly speaking, if there's any truths that are intentional in their semantics, then we already know too well no physical theory can accommodate them. And of course, the ante has gone up ever since philosophers began taking hyper-intentionality seriously. Imagine demanding that a physical theory ground thoughts about impossible worlds. Since it's easy to show that Darwinian theory is a purely physical theory, it's no surprise that anyone who demands of science that it accommodate intentional contexts will have to repudiate Darwinian theory. Leave it to Jerry to make a cause célèbre out of an unpalatable necessity. It's pretty easy to show that Jerry's arguments against Darwin is just his argument against teleosemantics warmed over. And it's not too hard to show that phylogenetic Darwinism doesn't have to take this argument very seriously. The benefit of seeing this is not that it takes the mickey out of Jerry's critique of Millikan, Neander, Dretzky, and co. Rather, it should begin to suggest that no theory of content needs to solve the disjunction problem. What exactly is Jerry's beef with Darwinism in its home base of phylogenetic evolution? It's the disjunction problem all over again. We are supposed to imagine two distinct traits, T and T prime, only one of which is adaptive, but which are locally coextensive in the way that detecting a fly and detecting a fly or a BB or any of an indefinitely large number of other contentful states are locally coextensive in frog tongue snapping etiologies. Take some carefully chosen adaptive trait and one of its neutral or even maladaptive side effects. Consider the well-used example from the debates about selected effect analysis of biological functions, the trait of circulating the blood and making thump-thump noises, pumping and thumping, I think Mohan said. Very nice. Since they both go together, owing presumably to physical law acting on local conditions, there's no way natural selection can pull them apart. Yet, it says that one was selected for and the other was not. That is, we want to accept the counterfactual that, were hearts to pump without making noises, they would still have been selected for. We want to reject the counterfactual that, were hearts to make noises without pumping the blood, they would have been selected for anyway. But Darwinian processes supposedly can't discriminate these two counterfactuals, showing that the first is true and the second false. Why not? Because so long as the properties are, as stipulated, locally coextensive, one property's frequency can't change without the others changing. So Darwin's theory can't say that one is selected for and the other not. This is the point Jerry made against teleosemantics. It can't tell whether fly flicking is selected for instead of fly or BB flicking, so it can't discriminate intentional content. Where did Jerry go wrong? The first and biggest mistake that Jerry made, along with a lot of other people, is to suppose that according to Darwinian theory, there is any such thing as selection for in nature. No, there's only selection against. The whole point of Darwin's theory is that in the creation of adaptations, nature is not active, it's passive. What is really going on is environmental filtration, a purely passive and often not very discriminating process that prevents most traits below some minimal local threshold from persisting. As Jerry might put it, Darwin doesn't care which traits get past the filter, including all the bizarre disjunctive traits any student of Nelson Goodman can come up with. Darwin only cares about which traits can't get by the filter. He and his theory have no time or need for selection for. It's a theory that gives pride of place to selection against, and that is not a defect, a weakness, an oversight, or a problem. It's its greatest strength. Why? The core of Darwin's theoretical achievement was to identify a purely causal mechanism that produces adaptations. Darwin's real theoretical achievement was to refute Kant's dictum that there will never be a Newton for the blade of grass. Darwin's signal achievement was theoretical, identifying the mechanism, random, that is blind, unforesighted variation, and passive environmental filtration that sculpts, and sculpts is really the right word here, that sculpts the appearance of purpose in nature, even though there is no reality of purpose operating in it. He uncovered the process that gives rise to the means-ends economy among biological parts and wholes. This means-ends economy produced by selection against is so widespread in nature that we have overgeneralized and come to detect it everywhere, even in places where it doesn't exist. That's what overzealous adaptationism is all about. Once it's recognized that Darwin ruled out selection for and insisted only on the causal efficacy of selection against, a lot of biological problems were resolved, including the existence of all those imperfections everywhere in nature. And it solved some philosophical problems as well, like why Darwin's processes needn't worry about the difference between real traits and Goodman-esque traits or Cambridge change traits or disjunctive ones like Jerry's. To see how the process that Darwin discovered, selection against, works, consider an example, one that we in fact talked about briefly yesterday. Two distinct gene products, one of which is neutral or even harmful to an organism, and the other of which is beneficial, which are coded for by genes right next to each other on the chromosomes. This is the phenomenon of genetic linkage. The trait that the genes code for will be coextensive in a population, a set of organisms, because the gene types are coextensive. Mendelian assortment and segregation doesn't always break up these packages with any efficiency. Only crossover and other non-selective against processes can do this. As Darwin realized, no process in nature, including ones he knew nothing about, like the Mendelian process of crossover, which breaks up these packages, no process in nature picks up on usefulness, convenience, need, adaptational value of anything. Once environmental vicissitudes break up the DNA, the two adjacent genes sit on, selection against can get started if one of the two proteins that they code for is harmful. The only thing that Mother Nature, aka natural selection, can do about the free-riding, maladaptive, or neutral trait whose genes are riding along close to the gene for the adaptive one is wait around for the genetic material to be broken at just the right place between their respective genes. Once this happens, in Jerry's words, Darwin can begin to tell the difference between them. Jerry's objection to this story is that the Darwinian theory can't tell the difference between these two genes or their traits until crossover breaks the linkage between the genes that is going to increase and the gene that's going to increase and the gene that's going to decrease in frequency. As we've already noted, Darwin doesn't have to tell the difference between them if one is an adaptation and the other is neutral. It's only selecting against. What's more, Darwinism tells us to look for adaptations all over the place and not to be anthropomorphic about it. In this case, the beneficial protein and its associated gene are not selected against just because the trait is beneficial to the organism. This case, the beneficial trait and its associated gene are not selected against because the trait is beneficial to the organism. Meanwhile, the harmful protein is not selected against because its trait has a trait beneficial to itself and to the harmful protein product. The trait is its location on the chromosome, hard by the gene for the beneficial protein. That's why neither harmful gene product nor the gene that produced it is selected against. It's got an adaptation. I suspect that Jerry and a lot of other people have not noticed that selection against isn't the contradictory of selection for. The failure to realize that these two terms are contraries and not contradictories is one of the strongest encouragements of overzealous adaptationism in biology and outside it. Why are they not contradictories? That is, why isn't selection against trait T just selection for trait non-T? Simply because there are traits that are neither selected against nor selected for. These are the neutral ones that biologists, especially molecular evolutionary biologists, insist upon so strongly. Selection for and selection against are contraries, not contradictories. If we, biologists, in fact, could define A as selected for to mean A is neutral or not selected against, on the model of weak preference in economic theory. We might call this weak selection for. And in fact, if Jerry's arguments begin to get traction, maybe biologists will shift to talking about weak selection for. If we adopt this terminological clarification, then there will not be much left to Jerry's arguments against Darwinism. But what if biologists benightedly insist that it's not enough to explain evolution purely as selection against traits, just bad enough not to make it through the environmental filter? Suppose they demand that Darwin's theory distinguish traits selected for from traits merely selected weakly for. Well, there's still other fundamental errors in Jerry's take on Darwin's theory that vitiate his criticism. Let's consider the sort of trait that Jerry thinks differ in regard to adaptation, traits that he thinks differ in regard to adaptation, and just can't be selected, separated by selection. Consider, for example, the property of binding oxygen, and the property of reflecting red light, the very example that Paul used yesterday. These two properties are coextensive in all metazoans because the heme molecule that transports oxygen contains iron, and it's iron in the molecules that makes them red. The problem, Jerry says, is that natural selection has been able to select for oxygen transport without selecting for reflecting red light. For it to be able to do so, natural selection has to make it true that, and here we have counterfactuals, if a molecule binds oxygen, then there would be selection for its presence in metazoans, and false that, if a molecule binds red light, there would have to be selection for its presence in metazoans. Jerry argues, for the former counterfactual to be true, requires that there be a law to the effect that if a molecule binds oxygen, then there's selection for its presence in metazoans. But there is no such law. In fact, there are no laws about selection of any trait. Now, the argument that Jerry gives for this claim that selection is that selection is context-dependent and laws can't accommodate all the different contexts, so there are no statable counterfactual supporting universal generalizations of the sort required for the theory of natural selection to be true. No laws about selection for, no natural selection, Darwin's theory is wrong. Here I was going to cut a section of my talk about what Jerry has to say about special sciences, but something that Laura said yesterday has encouraged me to reinsert it. It's remarkable to read the exponent of the existence of laws in the special sciences making the demand that Darwin produce laws of selection supporting such unqualified counterfactuals. Nothing could be easier than making the tout quoque point that the same challenge can't be met by any of the alleged ceteris paribus laws of the special sciences. In fact, the temptation is so great that for at least a paragraph or so, I'm going to succumb to it. Recall the famous arguments of special sciences or the disunity of science as a working hypothesis, 1979. The argument that the proprietary regularities of the special sciences are not derivable from those of physics. Jerry's example was Gresham's law that bad money will always drive good money out of circulation. Another example is the Phillips curve regularity that increases in the rate of inflation, increase employment. Standard feature of macroeconomics. Did we diss macroeconomics or econometrics yesterday? I can't remember. Of course, Pache Jerry's unargued assertion, these laws, quote, end quote, don't support the counterfactuals Jerry needs them to support. Take Gresham's law, for example. There are many cases where this doesn't happen and some cases in which the reverse happens. The only way to avoid these problems is to qualify these laws repeatedly until they become analytic truths. Alternatively, one can deny Gresham's law as a law at all and allow that it is a shorthand way of adverting to a set of insights about particular cases of monetary history which, without being laws, do support difficult to exactly specify counterfactuals that were true in those historical cases. The same goes for the Phillips curve local invariant regularity of macroeconomics and all the other inexact, ceteris paribus, so-called laws of the special sciences. If Jerry's favorite laws in the special sciences can do explanatory work without supporting broad, unqualified, robust counterfactuals, then of course so can the non-counterfactual supporting statements about selection against, weak selection against, and for that matter, selection for, if there are any, that he and lots of other people believe Darwinism requires. Where are the real laws that underwrite these local causal claims and their associated counterfactuals? This is an important question to which the philosophy of biology provides an answer that we can generalize to all the special sciences. There are no laws about what are common and peculiar to selection against or to selection for, but that's because there are no laws in biology or in any of the special sciences. There are lots of well-supported counterfactuals in biology, especially in evolutionary biology, ones that Darwin's theory supports. How's that if there are no laws? That's the question that Jerry's asking, and he asked it repeatedly yesterday. It's Darwin's theory, or rather the processes that Darwin discovered for sculpting adaptations that exclude the possibility of laws of selection or of any other sort of biological laws for that matter. This is a recognition due in its full originality to John Beatty, the recognition that all biological regularities that obtain on the Earth are contingent on the evolutionary processes of blind variation and environmental filtration. Any contingent generalization true of all or most or many of the members of any biological kind obtain only in virtue of the operation of blind variation and environmental filtration on local conditions. Their dependence on local conditions makes them all non-nomological. Moreover, for the same reason, they will cease to obtain at some point in the future owing to the operation of the same process on local conditions. Nothing in biology is forever. Here's a quick but fairly complete tour through the biological regularities that make it clear why none are laws and all are only local and temporarily invariant regularities. Beginning at the lowest level of generality, there are claims about particular species. Humans have 23 chromosomes. Robins' eggs are blue. As generalizations, these propositions are falsified, of course, by random variation that is continually producing counterexamples. The regularities came to be roughly true as the result of natural selection against operating on local conditions. They may not even remain roughly true. Predators glomming onto and selecting against blue eggs, and blean ones for that matter, will put an end to this regularity, or else to robins altogether. Moving up the higher taxonomic scale, we find regularities like snakes have scales or mammals have four-chambered hearts. Such regularities are also false and made so by the same processes that make regularities about particular species false. Mutations are constantly making them false, but of course the variants produced by those mutations are selected against, so they don't persist very long. Then there are the apparent regularities that cut across higher taxa, like Arctic species have lower surface area to volume ratios than non-Arctic species in the same families, because lower ratios of surface to volume reduce heat loss. Not only are all of these generalizations vitiated by exceptions, but even if they happen to be true for some period, universally true for some period, we can be confident that local conditions somewhere and somewhen will make them false. On the other hand, we can employ the foregoing generalizations in explanations. They are not laws and don't pretend to be. Rather, they summarize local conditions that obtain in virtue of much more fundamental laws operating on local conditions. These biological regularities are local, historically contingent patterns. The only counterfactuals they support are equally local and hedged around with ceteris paribus clauses. Here are two more well-known regularities made approximately true for limited time by the forces of natural selection. Mendel's laws of segregation and Mendel's law of independent assortment. I won't bother reading them. They're probably known to all of you. Consider the most fundamental claims about all biological systems, the propositions that get as close to being laws in biology as anything, or as close to being universal, exceptionless truths that support counterfactuals. All genes are composed of DNA, and the central dogma of molecular biology enunciated by Francis Crick in 1958. Genetic information moves from the DNA to the RNA to proteins, but never backwards from proteins to RNA to DNA. If either of these propositions was ever true, it's true no longer, owing to the arms race that produced the retrovirus. There are lots of models, of course, especially mathematical models in biology, and biologists call some of them laws, such as the Hardy-Weinberg law or the Fisher sex ratio model. These models, of course, are mathematical truths. They support no synthetic, contingent, causal counterfactuals. Like Euclid's axioms, they are approximated to greater or lesser extent in some domains and not in others. Indeed, owing to the operation of blind variation and environmental filtration, the same mathematical model may apply to some populations at one time and fail to apply to the same population at another time. Because the process of blind variation and environmental filtration can make or break, indeed does make and break all of these regularities, none of them are laws, but they have important explanatory roles in biology. They have these roles only because of the operation of real laws on local conditions in which they emerged and which enable them to persist. Well, what are these real laws that underwrite the causal diagnoses made by the local regularities? Jerry thinks that the relevant real laws underwriting all these local regularities have to be some laws that mention natural selection and, in particular, selection for. He says that the laws have to be of the form, if X has property P, then X is selected for. And he has a nifty argument to show that there's no such law. I'm worried about whether this is 13 or not. Have I? No, I think we're right. But that's not the law. The law of the form, if X has property P, then X is selected for, is not the law Darwin needs to underwrite all the regularities we have canvassed above. All Darwin needs is the law that every case of adaptation is the result of a process of blind variation and passive environmental filtration of selection against. It's pretty easy to show the role this law plays in arranging the local facts reported in all the spatio-temporally restricted regularities of biology. This generalization is plainly contingent. We can imagine circumstances that would tend to falsify it. Evidence of the intervention of a designing deity, or the repeated spontaneous appearance of arrangements that fulfill the complex means-ends economies that lead us to credit traits with being adaptations, or again, evidence of Lamarckian processes whereby use and disuse in one generation leads to adaptational improvements in later generations. There are doubtless other alternative hypotheses. Moreover, this generalization is well-grounded in physical theory. In fact, it identifies the only mechanism that physics countenances for the emergence of adaptations. Physics rules out real goals, purposes, ends, teleologies in general as causal forces, and it's done so since at least 1660. Because of this self-denying ordinance, physics therefore requires that any physical process that builds adaptations has to start at a point of zero adaptation and build the merest, tiniest, first sliver of an adaptation from nothing at all, and do so by purely physical processes. In fact, there's only one way that physics will ever permit itself to try to build any adaptations at all, from the state of zero adaptation. Physics requires that any process in nature that is asymmetrical be driven by the second law of thermodynamics. The law that entropy, disorder, almost always increases, and that local increases in order must almost always result in greater disorder elsewhere. All the other fundamental laws of physics are time symmetrical. The processes they describe don't have an intrinsic time order from earlier to later. Any process that goes on in one direction must be driven by the second law. That means processes that build adaptations which are asymmetrical processes par excellence, have to be driven by the second law. It also requires that they be wasteful processes, using up more order in producing adaptation than the order that the adaptations constitute and maintain. It's clear that the only way to build adaptations consistent with these two requirements of physics is to start by processes that randomly build large numbers of alternative molecular structures just through the operation of thermodynamic noise, and then wait. Wait for what? For one or more of these molecules to turn up randomly that combine thermodynamic stability with some kind of replicability. Eventually, out of sheer thermodynamic noise, there may come to be a molecular structure sufficient to withstand the local environment and that also encourages the emergence of copies of itself out of the atoms circling around in the local environment. This can happen by templating, by catalysis, or by otherwise producing copies of itself. You probably don't have to wait more than 500 million years once the chemical constituents of the early Earth are around for this to start to happen. Once it does start to happen, iteration of the same process will produce more and more adaptation at greater and greater expense, just as the second law requires. And eventually you get us and global warming. The important thing to notice about this scenario for making adaptations is that it is the only one that physics will permit, and that it is the process of natural selection that Darwin discovered. But it's the operation of the laws of physics on local conditions that produce the process of blind variation and environmental filtration that sculpts adaptations. That's the only thing that all adaptations have in common. What distinguishes them from one another are the local conditions in which their incipient forms emerged, the local conditions in which these forms were improved, and the local conditions in which they were worsened and eventually became extinct. to get the counterfactuals that Darwinism really needs to support to come out true, all you need are the laws of physics operating on local boundary conditions. Of course, you will need a lot of these laws and a lot of detail about the boundary conditions to get the details right. To illustrate, let's consider the two counterfactuals about heme molecules that Darwin really needs to get right. They're not the ones that Jerry thinks Darwin needs to get right. They're these. Right? It should be true that if a molecule didn't bind oxygen well, then it wouldn't have been, then it would have been selected against for its presence in metazoans. And it should be false that if a molecule didn't reflect red light, then there would be selection against its presence in metazoans. So why does the binding oxygen counterfactual come out true and the reflecting red light counterfactual come out false? Well, given the physical and chemical laws that drive the processes of respiration and the local environmental conditions on Earth under which being aerobic evolved to be almost, but not quite universal among metazoans, variations that enhance oxygen binding among these metazoans would lead to more offspring, and ones that reduce it would lead to fewer. The same almost universal claim can be made for molecules that reflect red light, The same almost universal claim cannot be made for molecules that reflect red light better or worse than iron complex molecules like hemoglobin. No law about selection for operating, because there are no laws of selection for or against. None are needed. The laws of physical chemistry operating on local conditions do all the work. Just check out any textbook of molecular biology and you'll see. One might be tempted to think that there's a distinct putative Darwinian law-like statement that identifies what all adaptations have in common. They all result from the operation of the so-called principle of natural selection, PNS. The PNS is a pretty notorious bone of contention in the philosophy of biology. Philosophers have taken almost every conceivable side of the question of whether it is any part of biological theory, whether it is a law or not, and if so, how its crucial terms, fitter than and probably, are to be understood, as well as its relations to its substitution instances, especially ones that seem to make it come out false. The long and the short of this debate is that who is right about these matters, and about whether the PNS is a law or not, turns pretty much on what you decide about the meanings of those two terms, fitter than and probably. If fitter than is an accounting term, as Bill Wimsett puts it, which conveniently summarizes all the local causal factors that determine demographic shifts from generation to generation among populations, then the argument that the PNS is a definitional truth becomes pretty compelling. The widely held probabilistic propensity definition of fitness is another reason for treating the PNS as a definition. So understood, the antecedent of the PNS makes a claim about probabilistically expected numbers of offspring, and the consequent makes a claim about the objective chances of certain demographic outcomes. And it turns out to be an example of what David Lewis called the principal principle. Depending on how these two types of probability are related, the PNS sails very close to the winds of analyticity. To summarize, it's just a mistake to suppose that the theory of natural selection should be replete with generalizations about what ecological variables, and here I'm quoting Jerry, what ecological variables determine the relative fitness of phenotypes. Jerry says, quote, "The idea is that its ecological laws, laws that apply by virtue of a creature's exogenous relations that support counterfactuals about which traits the creature would be selected for if it had them." No, no, no. Jerry, you don't understand biology. In Fodor speak, biology is a science without its own proprietary laws. In fact, all of the special sciences are sciences without proprietary laws. Now we've settled Jerry's hash, the one he made of the theory of natural selection on its home base of phylogenetic evolution, we can go back to his original arguments against teleosemantics and consider what we should make of them. The first thing to notice is after 50 years or so of trying to come up with a purely causal theory of psychological content that is completely semantics-free, no one has yet succeeded. And that includes Jerry's own beloved asymmetrical causal dependence theory. Physicalism dictates that the psychological states and processes that have intentional content are just upgraded neural states that track the proximate and non-proximate environment with discriminating enough sensitivity to qualify as representations of particular states of affairs. What counts as discriminating enough a representation is relative to the function of the neurological structures that embody the representation. Since, pace geri, functions are selected effects, that already makes teleosemantics the only possible candidate for a theory of content that is itself intentionality-free, that satisfies the physicalist demand that intentional content be upgraded non-intentional content, on pain of begging the question of how intentionality is possible. The reason teleosemantics is the only game in town is that Darwinian natural selection is the only way to get the appearance of purpose wherever in nature it rears its pretty little head, and that includes inside the brain. As we saw, physics excludes all sources of the appearance of purpose except blind variation and environmental filtration. If, as is obvious, the most minimal functionalism about the mind is right, then intentional states like beliefs and desires have to have a function, usually to produce word-to-world or world-to-word fit, to use Searle's language. So even if the words are morphemes in a Fodoresque language of thought, there's still no option but to go teleosemantic. We have to treat the neural content fly at XYZT as a matter of Darwinian shaping of the relevant neural circuits that control frog tongue flicking. These circuits have to be the victims of phylogenetic and ontogenetic processes of blind variation and natural selection. That's the only way they're going to get their purposive appearance, their adaptive character. If teleosemantics is the only game in town, it can't solve the disjunction problem. Then the right course is to bite the bullet, to go eliminativist, at least up to the point of denying that neural states have to have as their content specific, particular, determinate, unique statements which attribute non-disjunctive properties and relations to non-disjunctive objects. Thought really is much less determinate than language lets on. That makes language, of course, less determinate than it lets on, too. The denial that the frog, or we for that matter, think about flies instead of some never-to-be-expressed disjunction of flies or BBs or little black dots or, is one that we should take with utmost seriousness. The disjunction problem is not an objection to teleosemantics. It's a fact of life for biological creatures like us. As for Jerry, it turns out he's done us a favor. He's shown that the real consequence of rejecting a Darwinian approach to the mind is to reject a Darwinian theory of phylogenetic evolution. This forces us to take seriously a notion that otherwise would not have had much of a chance, that when it comes to the nature of mental states, indeterminacy rules. This is an insight that should have the most beneficial effect on freeing cognitive neuroscience from demands on the adequacy of its theories that it could never meet. Maybe it's not as important an insight as the one attained by running a modus tollens on Einstein, but then it's an important one nonetheless.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.